Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your Chantress of Everything Valuable and Beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. And I'm so pleased to have on the program today James Glisson. And the reason he's on the program today was we just had an announcement come out that he's been named Chief Curator at our museum, our Santa Barbara Museum of Art. He was curator of contemporary art, but he still is. And on top of many other hats that he's wearing at the museum. But the announcement came out that he's going to be our chief curator. And I had the great kind of honor last night of looking at his background, all the places he's worked, and all the shows that he's curated. And it struck me that James has a unique toolbox, I guess you could say, a unique toolbox, because he's a little bit of an architect, he's a little bit of a psychologist, he's a little bit of a stage manager, visual historian, and he's using all these talents to put together a show that has a thematic backbone. And in many cases, the shows that I was looking into, for example, St. Louis Museum of Art and Northwestern's Museum there, places in Chicago that he's worked, he kind of leans towards, and this is something I wanted to discuss with James, he leans towards a five-part presentation thematically in many cases, in many shows. And we'll discuss that and how that comes to be, but I want you to know, dear listener, how a show comes together is a real effort and a real talent to make something happen like a curated show. At the end of the show today, I want to talk about two shows and give you examples of how James works. I want to talk about a show called The Legacy of Giving, the Lady Leslie and Lord Paul Ridley Tree Collection that he's curated July 7th through November 3rd. The other show I want to talk about as far as his craft is concerned is called In the Making. And it's really interesting because it is a show that spans about 50 years of the collection of contemporary art at Santa Barbara Museum of Art, with the exception of one piece. So July 21st to March 9th. So James has got two shows that he's curated up at the same time. And I want to talk a little bit about how that happens and the kind of work that's involved. So, James, welcome, and thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me and for a very generous introduction.
Well, I want to tell our listeners a little bit about your background, too, because I think it's pretty unique. First of all, we talked about the idea that James was hired in February of 2020. And when he was hired, he was on this program. We talked about his background then. We want to refresh. It's been 4 years. Amanda Cruz was on our show not too long ago. We talked a little bit about her staff, but she mentioned that in the press release where James was announced to be chief curator, she said this about him: his scholarly rigor and community outreach are perfect for us. And she said many good things about James. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the shows that he's curated. Going Global, Abstract Art at Mid-Century was a show that I loved, and that was 2023. Okay. Out of Joint, Joan Tanner, amazing show in 2023. Scenes from a Marriage, Ed and Nancy Kleinholz, that was 2023. Inside Outside was 2023. Serenity and Revolution, 24. And Born Digital 2024. And I want to mention he's had some publications as well. There's a book out of the University of Chicago Press, The Architecture of Collage, Marshall Brown 2022, where James got together multiple scholars for the show he did on the artist. And then I would say, I don't know if you guys know this, but a museum just doesn't get given all the artwork, and they just don't get taken. There's a, here you go. Here's all of, you know, our, no, the museum actually seeks out a collection. So the biggest achievement, I think, that our town of Santa Barbara can celebrate about James is that he's responsible for the museum's acquisition of over 100 artwork in just the 4 years that he's been with us. And some of the notable artists that I was so happy to hear we've acquired, Marshall Brown, Ann Craven, Narcisco Martinez, Nancy and Ed Kleinholz, Jane Dixon, Wyatt Kahn, Keith Meyerson. Love Keith Meyerson.
Yeah.
Love Keith Meyerson. We've acquired a Keith, Helen Frankenthaler, some big names, and Joan Mitchell. So that was just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, I looked at the you know, 90 to 100 names, and they're all fantastic. One of the things I want to talk with James about in our short hour, and I can kind of reflect a little bit about what a chief curator actually does. Well, he oversees his staff, number one. He has Susan Tai, curator of Asian art, and the wonderful Charles Wiley, in photography and new media. He oversees those two. And then importantly, we're going to talk a little bit about this. He shapes exhibits and acquisition programming, and he leads the staff in his direction. And not the least of which, he oversees the care of 26,000 works of art. Can you imagine? 26,000. So where does he come from? Well, he was previously at the Huntington, San Marino. He was curator of American art there. And he, interestingly, that collection has been touched by the hands of James, because he brought contemporary art into programming for the Huntington. And for the Huntington and the Getty, he curated a show called True Grit. I didn't see it, but I looked at it. True Grit, American prints, 1900 to 1950. How cool is that? We've got some real revolutionary printmakers in that time. He has held posts at the Art Institute of Chicago, St. Louis Art Museum, The Block at Northwestern, and that's where he earned his PhD in art history, was at Northwestern. And James, I was a chair of there. Chairs were, it was a program that if you were in a top grade in your class in your junior year, you could spend your senior year as a freshman at Northwestern. And so okay. I was a chair of at Northwestern when I was a kid. I was my senior year. I loved it. And, you know, I was born and raised in the Chicago area. So as you can hear in my accent, I'm sure.
Okay.
Anyway, cool. So now we have a little background about you. Now I want to talk specifically. Let me hear you talk about a legacy of giving. Now, this is a collection that was donated by the Ridley Trees, and it's pretty wide in its breadth. But now you're going to present it, and you're going to present it in themes, and you're going to pull some works together. I think there was out of many pieces of art that Lady Leslie Tree gave, was there about 20 or 30, oh, 30 in the show. James took 30 artworks, and then took those 30 and developed about four or five themes around those 30. I looked at those 30, James, last night, and I couldn't. I mean, I see where you're coming up with the themes. But if you said to me, okay, take these 30 pieces, Elizabeth, and think of five themes they all fall into, I couldn't have done it.
Well, thank you for that. I do want to say, just a quick comment about the role as chief curator. I'm really there to facilitate other people and set up systems and structures and all of that. So the very good team that we've got here can do their work. And Charlie and Susan are pros and very, very accomplished in their respective realms. So I think, you know, a lot of the job is facilitating and helping out and moving things along where I can be, you know, where I can do that. So the existing team here is really strong. So there's, I don't, you know, it's not too hard with a great team. But getting back to a legacy of giving, early on, I like to work thematically, clearly. I don't always work thematically, but I think it's important for visitors to have an idea that they can hold on to and an idea that they can see or connect with in the work, that it's not something textual or something outside the artwork, that they can walk through the galleries and pick up on it. So I started from that. And then I also started from Leslie Ridley Tree's views about education and views about community service. And so I didn't want to do a show that was all about her. I wanted the show to be about the artworks that she gave to the museum with the intention that they be tools and bridges for connection to the community here. And thinking about that, I wanted to do a project that showed that there are issues in the 19th century that are similar to our own issues. So environmentalism, feminism, art as a way to escape from contemporary problems. Those are all very familiar. And also the artist as influencer, but circa 1870. So I think when looking to the art of the past, it can be very powerful to show that many of the issues these artists were grappling with weren't that different than those that we're dealing with today.
So Richard's giving us a sign we got to go to quick break, but I have to say it's some of the themes that you're pulling out, like this environmentalism, expanding roles for women, artist branding, and the role of museums and galleries, et cetera, et cetera. And fantasy art and historic art, you know, there's this idea of the 19th century, you know, there's the ideas that it's a resurgence of many things, especially historical images. And it's one of these really interesting periods, I think, in all it design. For example, for me, I look at 19th century furniture design, and everything is a revival. Revival this, revival that, revival Egyptian, revival Tudor, revival French court, et cetera. And there's so many revivals going on in the 19th century that there's a backward look. Everyone is scared of the future. So let's look back. Yeah. You know, this is sort of where you're pulling out the Dante Gabriel Rossetti and the Frederick Layton, you know, as an example of let's get scared and look backwards. Yeah. But I want to talk about that for sure. And then your idea of women and artistic careers for women, so important. If you look at the sales rooms these days, James, the auction sales room, women marginally, were, you know, they were marginalized for so long as far as the prices that they could achieve. And now they're at the top of the heap as far as, you know.
Go ahead. It has certainly changed. You know, we had a gift of a Bart Morisot painting from Leslie, which is incredibly rare, a Bart Morisot drawing, and then a Cassatt pastel. And I felt like I had to talk about how these two are, remind people, share with people how these two women negotiated careers in a really very hostile environment, and what made the difference for both of them.
So I would love to talk about that a little bit, about how they're using, they're revolutionizing the art world by using domesticity. It's very, it's very clever. It's wonderful.
It's not just that. I mean, the subject matter is what they have access to. You know, that's what they can, they don't have access to nude models, but they do have access to the home. But then in both cases, they're really a lot more radical, more abstract in ways than the male counterparts. And certainly Cassatt, we don't have any prints on view, but in her printmaking, people are still trying to figure out what she was doing technically. But both of them, you know, kind of tear the picture plane and tear the image almost into tatters, and they start to float away. I mean, in many ways, they're the most formally radical and innovative, which also comes through in the examples that the museum now has on view and now has in its permanent collection.
I have to just say that before we go to quick break, that Leslie Ridley Tree spent 25 years donating or underwriting artworks for our museum, of which she gave 58 pieces.
Yep.
So, you know, James had a lot to look at, a lot to choose from. And when we get back from the break, I want to ask him how, you know, looking at 58 works of art, like I said to you, James, how do you then narrow down to 5 themes? I mean, mm-hmm. you're looking at that and you're saying, okay, what made that connection in your mind mm-hmm. to the 19th century and to some of the themes that we're facing today, especially mm-hmm. how polarized we are today?
Yeah.
And how that, you know, we're talking the mid-19th century, in many cases, there's a terrific polarization as
exactly.
well.
Exactly. It's a violent century. It's a violent and difficult century.
Yeah. So we could get back from the break. I want to take a little bit of time and talk about that. Also, Richard, I sent you some music. I don't think we're going to hear it, but James, I picked some music especially for you that you'll hear. Oh. If you listen to the show, we re-air on Friday nights at 8 okay. p.m. and Sunday at 11 a.m. Okay. So don't turn that down. Back in a minute with James Glisson. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart, honor of talking with James Glisson. Why am I talking with James? Well, he's just been named chief curator at the Santa Barbara Museum of Art, and he's also remaining on his post as curator of contemporary art, which he's done a magnificent job. I try to see all the shows that he curates, and I'm always impressed with the fact that he's got at least one guiding theme, and many times there's 4 or 5 that you know that you're being led by an expert hand who's really looked at the work and really understood how the work fits. And a great example is a show that he's got up right now, and I urge you, dear listener, take a look at it, A Legacy of Giving, the Lady Leslie and Lord Paul Ridley Tree Collection. Leslie was on the board of trustees at the museum for 15 years, and then finally they made her life honorary trustee. She was so valuable. She was the lead contributor, I don't know if you knew this, to 1980s and 2021 museum renovations, lead contributor as well. And I'm talking support in monetary and philosophical terms as well. She sponsors exhibitions, and she provided for the Ridley Tree Education Center at the McCormick House on Arrillaga Street. James was mentioning her huge outreach as far as education is concerned. She underwrote art classes and camp programs, amazing stuff, and then spent 25 years donating, underwriting the 58 artworks, which James is credited with taking 30 and mounting the show. And then in the notes to the show, I found a sentence that I would like James to talk about, because this is a parallel. What James is doing in the show, and I had a chance to take a look at it, is that he is also giving us a teaching aid to the mid-19th century in a really significant way. But here's the quote that resonated with me. A legacy of giving as a show is really about a legacy of teaching. And I don't know if James said that, but he was quoted. It was in the material somewhere online last night, and I was thinking, wow, how interesting, because the show actually teaches us a lot about the 19th century and does it in parallel universes. So James, talk to me a little bit about your insistence on including in the show throughout the months that it's going to be up, the conjunction with other not-for-profits that are teaching not-for-profits that Lady Leslie Tree supported as well. You've got a program like at least once a month, sometimes twice a month, with various other not-for-profits in our community. And I covered last week, Friday, the Carrot Revolution concert. And I had the quartet on the air with me talking about, you know, playing at the museum, and they did a wonderful job. James, they are so young. They're so, they're not, I mean, I don't think there's one that's older than a college junior in that quartet.
So, well, the museum has collaborated with Music Academy of the West, and Nate and Indigo over at Music Academy are just wonderful colleagues to work with. I have to give credit to Patsy Hicks and Christy Thomas here at the museum and our education department, because they've really led the charge for community connections and making all of those events happen. But I want to back up a little bit and say a bit about sort of philosophically how museums should be working. And, you know, really, if you don't have an audience and you don't have people in the galleries, you don't have a museum. Just art on the wall is not enough. That's just a collection. And so to me, artworks need to connect to other times, other places, other people, to the amazing minds. I happen to like contemporary art and work with living artists, you know, the amazing things that they're cooking up. So art is a connection and a bridge. And I think education is all about bridging and connecting. So that's, to me, it's a very kind of meta philosophical view of what museums should be doing. And it's also a view that's in alignment with Leslie Ridley Tree and Leslie Ridley Tree's philanthropic pursuits and ambitions. So she understood when she and then her husband, Paul, who predeceased her, you know, when they were putting this material together, it was knowing it would eventually come to the museum and it would be on public view and it would connect with a public, you know, it would be for visitors to the galleries and guests in the galleries and the community to see. So I felt like for all of those reasons, as I started to look at the 50 odd gifts that she and Paul made over the years, you know, what are ways that this art from 150 plus years ago, what are things that can tell us about the 21st century in our own moment? Because sometimes with older art, it can be harder to connect. Contemporary art frequently is loud and, you know, loud and boisterous, or the artist is there physically and can guide you through it. But with older art, I think it can take a little bit more of an effort. And it occurred to me early on that it made sense to focus on the French and British material in their collection from the 19th century, because there's so much of it and such an obvious strength. And then, as you know, the 19th century was a fraught time of war and revolution and colonialism. And technology, the first wave of industrialization and technology actually changing everyday life with railroads and telegraphs and steamships. And the social dislocation and the revolutions of the 19th century that this all brought into play. So many of these works to our eyes from a distance look very placid, but the historical background was quite tumultuous. And so it felt to me like the right, you know, good way to make them right. It made them seem much more relevant to the early 21st century here in the United States. And there's this magnificent Courbet seascape. And I think one direction that I guess another person might have gone is to talk about that Courbet seascape and how the clouds sort of look like an abstract painting and how we're focused on individual brushstrokes. But, how it maybe started to look like Marth Rothko. And you know what? That's fine and that's completely legitimate. But the fact is that Courbet was a big personality, and that he cared about selling and he cared about the market. And he has all these, he's very quotable. He has this wonderful quote where he says, if I'm no longer controversial, I will no longer be appreciated, or I'll sort of disappear. At one point he's jailed for his activities in the revolution of, I think it's 1870. It might be the 48 revolution. And from jail, he says, he speculates on whether or not the notoriety would cause the value of his paintings to go up. But with the seascape, with the seascape in our collection, it turns out he figured out that seascapes were easy to paint and he could sell them pretty well. And this is what he says. And understood that all maybe, you know, that bad press is not necessarily bad for you, that it's still press and it still gets attention. And like a 19th century influencer, he understood how to get newspapers, because that was the mass media of the time, how to get the attention of the critics and how to get the attention of people and how to stay in the public eye. And that's certainly something that's quite familiar to all of us these days, thinking about social media. The other part that really struck me was thinking about the Barbizon School in the French, various French artists who, starting in the 1830s, were going to the forests of Fontainebleau, south of Paris. And many of those landscapes, to me, don't look like a healthy forest, or it's not particularly verdant. There's rocks, there's dead trees. And I was interested in what that signaled. It turns out that artists, in fact, that was their idealized landscape, and that they advocated with the French government to have set-asides and preservation. So it's one of the earliest documented instances of environmental preservation, so that they could paint the scenes they wanted to paint of aging beeches and oaks, and that they were fighting against what we would call monoculture. So the forest was being plowed as the hardwoods were dying out. They were being replaced by something that's called a Scott pine or a Baltic pine. That sounds like a very 21st century concern about the diversity of ecosystems. Their perspective was one that was more, we'll say, one of aesthetics. And then the environment that they wanted to see wasn't exactly wholly unstructured either. So that was kind of interesting, the way that what counts as natural is culturally specific.
Absolutely. And I just want to mention my thought when I was looking at that. And first of all, the Courbet, the market for Courbet in the art world is nowhere. And it's very interesting, because I think you now own probably the top of the heap of his work. I mean, basically, it's interesting to talk about two things that you said. Number one is that you could have gone into Rothko and the sky looks like this and that and the other. So you didn't shy away from the fact that figurative work is figurative work, and it's meant to be perceived as figurative work, even though structurally it has other aspects to it. That's number one. Number two, I think that it's interesting when you talk about the Barbizon work, because there's this impending, the palette is so gloomy, and there's this impending kind of ruination feeling behind it. And it does fit in so well with the 19th century love of anything half ruined.
Yeah, that's true. It does. That's very true.
I was laughing about that, you know, when you're talking about that. Anyway, Richard's giving us a sign. We have to go to quick break. It is an honor and a privilege to interview our new chief curator. Very proud that I interviewed him when he first came in February of 2020. I listened to that interview and talked about what he was planning to do with his new post as curator of contemporary art. Well, we've seen it, haven't we? We've got a number, at least 20 shows that he has curated in his field and have all been so interesting when you think about our museum that opened in 1941. It's been fantastic to see where James has led us into. Don't turn that down. We're back with James Glisson in 2 seconds. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. I'm speaking with James Glisson, who's our new chief curator at Santa Barbara Museum of Art. You might know him for his past 4 years. He's curator of contemporary art, and he's brought some amazing shows. Some of the shows that I'm thinking of, Scenes from a Marriage was great because it showed both the collaboration and the not so collaborative side of Ed and Nancy Kleinholz. That was 2023, Inside Outside, Serenity and Revolution, Made by Hand, Going Global, Out of Joint. All these are titles of some of the shows that James, just a few show that James has brought us. And we were talking a little about The Legacy of Giving, which is his show, Lady Leslie and Lord Paul Ridley Tree Collection, in which James picked 30 pieces that were donated by the Ridley Trees. And he uses the images to explore themes that are relevant to the 21st century. It's a really interesting idea of looking back by looking forward or looking forward by looking back. I don't know which is more appropriate to say, but the themes that he's talking about and focusing on, dear listener, environmentalism, the expanding roles for women in society, but also women as artists and artistic careers of women. And then fascinatingly, the role of commerce, the role of the market, the role of the art market, the role of the media to expand the market. And then finally, the most fascinating, I think, and the most relevant as far as 19th century history is the role fantasies, the artist themes of the old ways of life and cultures, and how they regret the forward movement of, you know, the machine that becomes, you know, the age of industrialism. Talk to me a little bit about the Dante Gabriel Rossetti that's in the collection.
So it's great piece in very good condition, was once owned by, I believe it was William Morris for at one point, and it's had some interesting history. It is an allegory, and I'm forgetting the names of the characters involved, but one of the women is in fact dead and is a ghost, and the other woman is living, and the man in between them is paying attention to the ghost while he's being sort of beckoned, shall we say, by the living woman. And there's, I believe there's two glasses of wine, one of which is empty or half full, and that's a kind of the symbolism, I think, both of longing, but also of someone who's actually absent. So it is definitely a painting about many layers. And this allegory is in fact about a dynamic within the Pre-Raphaelite circle. So there is this very backwards looking nostalgia for someone who's deceased on one level. And then there is the medievalism of it. So people are, the frame, the costumes people are wearing are many centuries out of date. And that's also backwards looking. But the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood generally was, and figures like William Morris in 19th century Britain were upset, understandably, by the ravages of industrialization across Britain and what it had done to British kind of traditional English life in villages. And their response to it as artists was to look to the medieval period and to the time of handcrafts and to the time of guilds that supported guilds, which supported craftspeople and ensured kind of consistent employment and support. Even their artistic circles, you know, their friendships and all of that kind of mirrored in a way their version of a world they knew really nothing about. I mean, in a way it was their fantasy of the past. But their circles of support mirrored some kind of broader supportive network, more supportive society, more sense of the common welfare and the common good than what they were seeing in Britain at that time. So there's lots of layers, and it's a very beautiful piece and tiny. The museum is very lucky to have it in its collection. It's pretty incredible. It's a well-known piece. It's reproduced. Yeah.
I was interested because, you know, I did not at first, until I looked at the history and the provenance of the work, I did not really understand there was a ghost. And then, you know, it was like, okay, it's such an, and you said, mentioned it as an allegory. It's very interesting because, you know, there's the famous grieving of Rossetti when his wife died, a very young wife, and then she was buried in, yeah, I think she was her early 30s. And when she was buried, of course, he was a poet as well. And he buried his poems with this wife. And then, of course, snuck back later and dug them back up.
Got them back.
So I thought that was interesting, looking at that work, thinking, okay, you know, there's this deep feeling of grief. Do you know, James, I don't want to put you on the spot, but do you know right around when that work was painted? Did it have anything to do with her death?
I believe it had to do with the death of a model, not his wife. And I just don't remember. And I don't want to say the wrong thing. So
right.
It's not at the tip of my tongue.
Right. So I think the model, yes, that could be both, that she was both his wife and his model. It could be, I don't know myself, but the thing is, it's really interesting. And so far as we were talking about this backwards look, and James was mentioning the cult of the medieval, you know, I'm talking to you, James, and I'm up here in my mountain house in Lake Arrowhead. Behind me, you can't see it, but in front, behind me is my bedroom, but in front of me is the 27 collected Ruskin's work. You know, I've got the leather bound first editions that I think are so interesting because Ruskin, of course, was a big philosopher and got the movement mm-hmm. started and was glorifying, for example, the Houses of Parliament mm-hmm. being built mm-hmm. in the medieval yeah, style and the Gothic style and everything, Gothic everything. So when we're talking about Rossetti, and James is mentioning that the costumes that are looking like they're from the 13th century, well, there's a reason for that. Yeah. And, you know, this is, I thought, one of the standouts of
It is. Yeah. It's a really great piece.
And then you contrast that with the English, also the English artist, Frederick Leighton. Tell me, can you do a little bit of comparison between the Rossetti and the Leighton?
Well, I think what I'd say is, but one of them is looking to their version of that being Rossetti, their version of the medieval and Renaissance period. And Leighton, who's really mostly a painter, doesn't make many sculptures, might be the only sculpture of significance he made, but not known for a sculpture. Leighton looked to classical antiquity, to Greece and to Rome.
Yeah.
It's the same, and in some ways, the impulse to go back to some cultural authority of the distant past is the same. The choice is a little bit different. So there's the appearance, let's say the appearance of the two pieces is quite different. The kind of intellectual structure of it is quite, in many ways, quite similar. What they do with that visually goes in a very different direction. But, you know, Leighton's looking to the sculpture of classical antiquity and, you know, way referencing the Lyakhowan in a broad way, but then also dealing with the aesthetic problem of making a sculpture in the round that's interesting from all angles. And that sculpture is not put in the middle of the room, but it's pretty interesting from all angles, which is hard for a single figure sculpture. That particular bronze also exists in a much larger version. There's a couple different sizes and casts, and I don't remember all of that anymore, but the small cast is what we have. Beautiful piece.
So I just want to say that it used to be, I had a professor teach us that one of the reasons that ancient Greece and Rome were used so much in the 19th century, especially in sculptures, is because it's a good excuse to have a nude around the house. So, you know, that was something that was, we have to go to quick break, but I have just a little short time to talk about the other show, which I thought was fascinating, In the Making, Contemporary Art at Santa Barbara Museum of Art. That is a show that James curated. That's July 21st to March 9th. 7 decades of art owned by the Santa Barbara Museum of Art. And what's so interesting is you go to that show, dear listener, and you'll see a work. And James has put a work that's maybe 50 years old next to a work that's maybe last year. And usually things don't happen like that, usually, in curatorship. So I want to talk about that genius move when we get back from the break. Hey, Richard, let's go to quick break. Don't turn that. James, you've got a few minutes. Just tell me about your other show, In the Making, Contemporary Art, Santa Barbara Museum of Art, from 1941 till today. Can you quickly just tell me what you were thinking mounting that show?
So the impetus for the show is a quote from Gertrude Stein attributed to her. and it's from about a century ago. And she said that you can be modern or you can be a museum, but you can't be both. And so I thought, well, maybe. And I thought, if you accept the idea that what is contemporary is always changing, you're never going to get it quite right. You'll always be behind the curve. That became the core idea of just thinking about how what counted as contemporary has changed since the 1960s.
So I just want to say, James, thank you for being with me, and congratulations on your position, Chief Curator. And it's been a pleasure. And
thank you.
I know I don't have to wish you, I don't have to wish you success. You're already there.
Thank you so much. And I please stop by the galleries and see the shows that are up.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye-bye.